Welcome back to The Civic Flame. I'm your host, Dr. Amber, and I'm coming to you as the government continues to be shut down, and just a few days after 7 million people were out in the streets across the United States protesting. It's a wild time to be an American, but I am happy to hear that among the No Kings protests, the only people causing mayhem and getting arrested were people attacking the protesters. It takes a lot to get 7 million folks out to protest, and even more to get them to do so in a way that doesn't break any laws or cause any damage. So while Congress may be mucking about, it looks like the people are still up and taking that civic responsibility seriously. Speaking of Congress, we are getting towards the end of the longest part of the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, or the legislative branch. Today, with sections 4 through 6, we are closing that gap pretty quickly. Let's talk about some of Congress's powers and responsibilities and some questions about what they can do. Let's go. Section 4 deals with elections and says, times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. This section is kind of vague in terms of what regulations are allowed and what they do in terms of elections, but it gets expanded on in a lot of statutes and federal law. Statutes are laws passed by the legislature. So in this case, Congress, but if it's a state law, then it's passed by your state legislature. So something your state house passes is a state statute. If you take a look at the U.S. Code, which you can do on Cornell Law School website, law.cornell.edu, that's where I look at it because I find it the easiest organized on there. But you can also find it on the Senate website at senate.gov, or you can just Google U.S. Code Law. You'll find the public laws of the United States broken up into 54 titles or subjects. Title 2 deals with Congress and has 65 chapters. Yikes! The 9 sections of Chapter 1 deal with elections. So we are in Section 7, which deals with the time, place, and manner of elections. What it says is, the next Tuesday, after the first Monday in November, in every even-numbered year, is established as the day for the election in each of the states and territories of the United States of representatives and delegates to the Congress, commencing on the third day of January next thereafter. What does this mean? Well, it kind of clarifies what the Constitution does, and it clarifies what it requires, and standardizes the elections across the states. Why? Because elections are expensive, and we don't want to run more of them if we don't have to. So we try to put all the federal elections on the same day across the country, part of an equal protection thing, and really important state elections get put on the state ballot at the same time. This saves the state some money, it saves people some attention spans, and it can really help a lot. So that's why when you go to your state to choose your senator or your representative, sometimes you'll see your governor on there or your secretary of state, or even somebody at your local level like your mayor or your select persons, and so on. You might notice that states have different times for primary elections, and that's because those have a lot more to do with what is going on at the state level. Remember that primary means first, and usually it's against somebody in your own party, so Democrat versus Democrat and Republican versus Republican. This leads to some problems in our political system because the most partisan, that means the most Democrat, Democrat, and the most Republican, Republican, that is the person who usually wins the primary. Now, that's a story for a different time and a whole conversation on why I believe partisan primaries and closed primaries are a threat to democracy. But for now, what you need to know is primaries are usually set by the state, so they can be on different days. This is why in presidential election years, you'll see the candidate polling ahead in New Hampshire or Iowa, and they're winning an election there. But it's still a little while until what we call Super Tuesday, where a lot of states vote. Those are usually primary elections, and really more about the DNC and the RNC than the actual election themselves. After the time, place, manner clause in the next paragraph of Section 4 comes some things about the start date of Congress. But this was changed by the 20th Amendment. Remember I told you before, there are a lot of parts of the Constitution that have been updated by amendment, and this is one of those parts. And so now the new session of Congress starts on the 3rd of January, rather than the first Monday in December. Those guys gave themselves a nice long extra Christmas vacation. Maybe the rest of us can get in on that action. But if you go to Article 1, Section 4 on the National Constitution Center's website, they have a section dedicated to common interpretations, which is a lot of what I said above, but they also have two really interesting debates on the federal versus state power and the way that works through election timing, and the role of legislatures in making any of these decisions. If you're going to be a real Constitution nerd, you need to get into some of these things. But if you're just coming along with me for the nerd light journey, we're heading to Section 5, which deals with Congress's duties. Yes, I really want to make a juvenile duty Congress joke. Don't judge me. Section 5 starts with rules about quorum, how many people you need to attend the meeting before you can officially get to work, and whether or not you can compel absent members to get their butts in gear and come to work. The next section is how you get all those committees in Congress. It says, each house may determine the rules of its own proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and, with the concurrence of 2/3 vote, expel a member. This can obviously be a big deal, and after the Civil War, definitely led to some fights. But basically, to preserve the separation of powers, the House and the Senate are supposed to keep their own houses, or chambers, in order. After the January 6th insurrection, there were some questions about whether the House was going to expel some of its members who were a little more insurrectionist sympathizer types, but not much really happened on that front, except for a few people being removed from committee assignments for a little while. But the next section is about the journal or record of proceedings that both chambers have to keep. And the last section deals with adjournment and says, neither house during the session of Congress shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than that in which the two houses shall be sitting. This may sound kind of boring and sleepy or weird, but it's actually a little bit interesting because whatever passes in the House and the Senate must be identical, so they need to work together. But we know that they don't always do that. So the founders basically said, because remember, the Articles of Confederation only had one chamber of Congress. The Articles of Confederation only had one chamber of Congress. So this idea of two chambers or a bicameral legislature was a little concerning to the people who wrote the Constitution, and they were worried that one or the other branch would resort to some kind of trickery, that they might close down one house and not the other, meaning that if anybody wanted to try and skip town rather than vote, that would be a problem. So the people who wrote the Constitution put this little clause in there about how they both have to agree to some extent to closing down the session. This has also been used to block some presidential power. The president has what is called a recess appointment. This means that when Congress is on recess, or not in session, the president can temporarily appoint a person to a job that would normally require congressional approval, but because it's a recess appointment, they can do it without congressional approval. So in 2007, Democrats and the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid did this to stop George W. Bush from using his recess power. And because bad ideas like to spread across both parties, in 2012, the Republicans in the Senate did the same thing to Barack Obama. You may be asking, is the entire U.S. political system controlled by toddlers? No, of course not. If you give them a nap and a cookie, toddlers become reasonable people. The United States government, on the other hand, will not. Section 6 gets away from specific responsibilities and talks about money. The first part of Section 6 basically says we need to pay them and we cannot arrest them except under certain circumstances, which does lead us to believe that the people who wrote the Constitution were pretty sure that at some point somebody in Congress would probably need to be arrested. They just wanted to let us know when and under what circumstances it was okay to do that. So what Section 6 says is, the senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid by the Treasury of the United States. They shall, in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place. Basically, this is taken to mean that anything in the course of their job, whether they are talking to their constituents or whatnot, they can't really be arrested for. And this has had some interesting questions if we know that people are inciting problems or what have you. How much is that covered by free speech? When something is not true, how much of that is not covered by free speech? And even if we can get to the bottom of those questions, what can we really do about it? Because we have this whole rule about how if it's something that they say on the House or Senate floor, there's a whole lot of legal protections. It gets a little complicated. And the next part of Section 6, believe it or not, gets more complicated because this is the emoluments clause. In this case, emoluments are like extra money. So the members of Congress, as what we just read says, gets some type of compensation, right? This is their amount of money. But the emoluments clause is supposed to keep them from profiting off of their office beyond their salary. So if you think of how like a CEO of a company gets a bonus in addition to their regular pay, the regular pay in this case would be income, and the bonus, because it's extra and probably untaxed, would be considered an emolument. There are lots of controversies, as you would imagine, over what the heck this means. One of the reasons Nancy Pelosi is considered a Dino or Dino, aka a D-I-N-O, Democrat in name only, is because she has regularly stood against stricter regulations on stock trading by members of Congress. I always laugh when people point to Nancy Pelosi as this super leftist because in the scheme of global ideas of what is left and what is right, she is center right. In the US, she might be center left, but really she's much more right wing than that. And a huge part of that is this issue of stock trading and this issue of money. The Brennan Center for Justice has an article by Maya Kornberg called Congressional Stock Trading Explained. And I recommend it because it does, well, explain what is up with congressional stock trading, what it means, how they do it, what it looks like, where the money goes, and so on. But this is just one of the many questions about the Emoluments Clause in Congress. Other questions include things like, do trips count? What if they're paid for by somebody? What if they're paid for by a lobby? What about campaign finance issues? What about jobs for staff members or family members? Promises of jobs after somebody's term is up, and so forth. Given the unique role of corporate and very expensive financial lobbying in the United States, this becomes harder to determine what an emolument is and what's just business as usual. Remember, lobbying is simply asking somebody to get what you want, right? If you have two kids who are trying to get extra dessert, they're going to lobby you. They're going to explain why it's a good idea. They're going to throw a fit, whatever. Lobbying in and of itself is simply a part of the political process. The professional corporate gatekeeping, lots of money lobbying, political action committees, and so on, that is not unique to the US, but among developed democracies, we have a lot more money flooding our political system than others. And so when you look at the state of what is an emolument, how is someone enriching themselves or potentially enriching themselves based on what's going on, it's a real question. Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, for quite some time was under some questions because a member of his family had invested heavily into EpiPens. And this was around the same time that he was helping push through legislation that said, instead of carrying an EpiPen with you, children in K through 12 public schools had to have two, one on their person and one that they left at the nurse's office. Because his family had a financial interest in selling more EpiPens, there was a real question of not just ethics, but to what extent is this an emolument? And most people said, well, he's not personally profiting off of it, so it's not an emolument, it's just an ethical question. But these questions get really thorny when we talk about who does and doesn't profit and what those profits look like. Section 6 guides us a little bit on this issue, but really, like so many other questions about Congress and their powers and their limits and their accountability, the founders expected the people to handle that by drawing our own lines and throwing the people in Congress out when we felt like they crossed them. This is why people in Congress actually love partisan politics. They want us to root for the D or the R because they know that as long as we're doing that, they don't really have to do their jobs, right? This is the problem with making it a team sport. As I say very often to my students, unless you are being paid by a political party in this country, you are not a Democrat or a Republican. Even if you vote for one party 100% of the time, what you are is an American. And you should be holding those people in all parties accountable, because otherwise, you're just doing unpaid work for a political party, and you should at least make sure they pay you. And then we'll have to look at the emoluments clause and, you know, see if that's acceptable or not. That's how it goes. So that's some of the nitty-gritty that goes into Congress. Next week, we're going to talk about some of the money stuff from Section 7 and the major section that gives Congress its powers in Section 8, which is pretty substantial. The week after, we'll do Sections 9 and 10, and then, can you believe it, move on to the presidency. In the meantime, share this widely. I deleted my Facebook account, and it definitely took a hit on getting the podcast out there. I also deleted TikTok. It turns out that that form of social media really is a young man's game, and it's not for me. But you can still follow me at Dr. Fun Sponge on Blue Sky, Instagram, Substack, and YouTube. I hope to see you out there, and we can all work together to answer the question, will the government shutdown end before we finish talking about Congress? Will it end before we finish talking about the Constitution? Will it end before Christmas? Stay tuned and find out. Until then, keep the civic flame burning bright. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge production in collaboration with writer Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. As always, thank you for listening.